It's the next level, right? It's that much more secret.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's Justin Carlson.
Justin Carlson.
Justin is the National Director of Clinical Education for U.S. Acute Care Solutions. He is also Director of Resident Research at St. Vincent Hospital in Erie, Pennsylvania. But today, Justin makes his MRAP debut as a special agent of ILCOR.
ILCOR!
Justin's been involved now with ILCOR for many years. He'll explain.
ILCOR is the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation, and it brings together several different organizations from across the globe to look at issues related to resuscitation and resuscitation science, to try to understand what is available in the evidence and come up with some guidance, some treatment recommendations based on whatever the best available evidence is.
Perfect. And I understand that you've got a couple of examples of guidelines that you have recently come out with that are very practical that you want to share with us. But just before we get into that, I just want to ask you a couple more things about ILCOR itself. And I guess the big one is, what makes ILCOR different? How do the guidelines contrast with, for example, those of the American Heart Association?
So one of the keys when we're thinking about resuscitation is the variability in resources. For many folks in the United States, especially in academic centers, there are a lot of resources there. There's all kinds of specialists, pretty much any test you could want, any procedure that you want done, you have access to all those resources. And that's great. But what about the billions of other people in the world who don't have access to those? And one of the keys with ILCOR is taking into account the variability in resources. So yes, how would you manage this patient who's critically ill in an ivory tower academic setting? But then how are you going to manage that patient in a rural or more remote area of India or China or Australia? And how do you bring in different cultures as well and incorporate that into the decision-making process? That's really one of the keys. So every aspect of ILCOR, each one of the subcommittees, has international representation so that we can come up with a global kind of treatment recommendation incorporating those values into it.
Is there a central office, a central base?
There are several different areas internationally that do several main parts of ILCOR. For example, American Heart is one of the larger organizations that contributes time and resources to it. So a good number of meetings and resources are here in the United States. There's also, though, partnerships that we have with medical librarians in various places throughout the world. The Belgian Red Cross, there's a lot of work that's done there on kind of the evidence review. So there are pockets all throughout the world where, depending on the resources that are needed, ILCOR relies more heavily on different areas.
So Justin, we went back and looked together at the past couple of years of ILCOR guidelines to see which things we had covered well on MRAP and which we hadn't. And you actually came up with a couple of recent, very recent guidelines that we really hadn't addressed at all. Tell us about those.
One of those is oxygen concentration during the resuscitation of newborns. And the other is actually a first aid intervention and what can be done when you have somebody who has presyncope. What interventions can you do as a bystander, as a first aid provider, to help those individuals and hopefully terminate the symptoms so they don't develop syncope?
So let's start off with the oxygen for newborn resuscitation. And you actually had a good case here to kick off the discussion. Tell us about that.
So I practice in northwestern Pennsylvania, and we have a fairly large population of Amish. And for those not familiar, the Amish are a group who don't use modern technology like cars or electricity. And they also don't often have access to healthcare, including prenatal care, and often have lower rates of childhood vaccinations than the general population. So a case that I had about 2 to 3 years ago was a lady who was 37 weeks pregnant and was pregnant with her fifth child. And because she was Amish and they don't use cars or electricity, it did take her and her husband a little bit of time to actually get to the hospital. So it was about 2 to 3 hours after the onset of contractions before she actually presented. She'd had no prenatal care and was told during her last pregnancy that she would need to go to the hospital if she ever got pregnant again because there was a problem with the previous baby's shoulder getting, quote, stuck. And so the patient, when she's in triage, says she can feel the baby coming and is actually taken right back to her room in the emergency department where she delivers almost as soon as she gets on the bed. And after the delivery, the child's blue, appears kind of limp, and really has minimal respiratory effort. So without going into all the details of APGAR or other elements of neonatal resuscitation, one of the key questions that was answered in the ILCOR document this year was actually, what do you do with regards to oxygenation in that scenario?
And that really has changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a total, I don't know if it's a 180 or a 270, but let's just say it's pretty different than what I was taught when I first took the neonatal resuscitation program way back when.
It is. And it's also different than what we may do in adults, which is why it's important to highlight this to talk about it. So let's first say precipitous delivery in the emergency department is pretty uncommon. We don't see it all that often. But up to 10% of the time, we do need to do some type of resuscitative effort. And sometimes that involves intubation or bag valve mask ventilation in these critically ill or in these ill-appearing neonates. And so what we might do in adults when we have someone who has poor respiratory effort or has impending respiratory failure, we would provide significant supplemental oxygen, right? So we pre-oxygenate them. We may put apneic oxygenation on while we're performing intubation. We may even have them on 100% FiO2 afterwards. Not saying that's always the right thing, but that is our traditional plan or traditional efforts in adults.
The evidence.
While the toxic effects of oxygen have been well known for quite some time, when you have prolonged oxygen or prolonged high oxygen, it's a little bit more controversial about what the effects are of high oxygen concentration for a short period of time. So the few minutes around the resuscitation of a neonate. And so what we looked at was, what if we compare 21% oxygen, so it's room air, versus 100% FiO2 and looked at outcomes in neonates with respiratory distress at birth? And so this PICO, this question, the primary outcome was all-cause short-term mortality, so in hospital or in 30 days. There were a bunch of other secondary endpoints, including long-term mortality, neurologic development, whether they developed any encephalopathy, those sorts of things. But the primary outcome was short-term mortality. In looking at the literature, there were 10 trials, multiple prospective randomized trials, comparing, again, low oxygen, so 21% room air, to 100% FiO2, data from over 1,000 neonates. And what's really surprising, what's really striking from this, is that short-term mortality was better with the lower oxygen level. So with 21% oxygen, the rates of short-term mortality were lower than with 100% oxygen. That difference actually resulted in a number needed to treat of 22. So you need to treat 22 neonates with 21% oxygen to save one life in the short term. And again, that's very different than how we look at it in adults, where we give oxygen for all sorts of things. We give it throughout the entire airway management and resuscitation process. But in neonates, and these were very short periods of time, the largest study in this group actually only gave 21% for the first 90 seconds. And if the patient didn't respond after 90 seconds, then they could escalate it to higher oxygen, higher FiO2 if need be. But even for very short periods of time, there appears to be a significant risk of high FiO2 in newborns that are having respiratory distress and need some element of resuscitation. What we came up with, the official ILCOR statement, is that we recommend against starting with 100% oxygen, and that's a strong recommendation based on the level of evidence.
Justin, that has huge implications because oxygen is expensive. Right. And the logistics of storing and transporting oxygen are enormous problems in the developing world.
And that's one of the real keys with this from an international perspective, is the outcomes are better when you use room air. So there's no additional cost. This approach, this initial approach to resuscitation, can be implemented at all settings, high resource and low resource settings. You may still need to titrate. There will still be patients where you need to escalate oxygen levels, but the starting point should not be 100% FiO2.
Prevention of syncope.
Let's talk about one other question that was addressed in the 2019 document, and that actually has to do with a first aid intervention for pre-syncope. So if we take a case, imagine you're suturing a chin laceration of a child, and the dad suddenly looks at you and says, "I don't feel so good. I think I'm going to pass out."
What position is he in? Is he sitting?
If
he's standing, right. It's your fault. You should have had him sitting. That's right. That's all I know.
It means you haven't done it enough to realize that that's a problem.
Right. Yeah.
Let's say he's sitting down, but even still is kind of curious about what you're doing with the laceration repair and is trying to look over, but then that's when he says, gosh.
You can see that he's about to go out.
So he's about to go out. So what do you do? You may be the only provider in the room. You can certainly always call for help. But what can you do to help with that individual who hasn't yet developed syncope, but has pre-syncope symptoms? What interventions can you do?
I can tell you what my mother would do. She would take I'm serious. She would take a glass of water, cold water, and she'd throw it right at your face. That's what she would do. Does that work?
We didn't find any randomized controlled trials of water being splashed in your face. However, you likely do some maneuvers when you get water splashed in your face that were looked at when we looked at some prospective trials. So there's a lot of different things that could be done, right? I mean, you can put in an IV, you can give people fluids, there's passive leg raise and some thoughts that may increase venous return. But one of the things that really came out while we were looking at this question was the use of physical counter pressure maneuvers. And what those are is, think of flexing a certain muscle group. So there are multiple methods that could be used. You could put in an IV and give IV fluids. You could do passive leg raise where there's thought that that increases venous return. What you also may do, though, is something called physical counter pressure maneuvers, where you actually have the person flex a certain muscle group with the thoughts that that actually may also help venous return and may abort the symptoms that they're having and prevent them from progressing on to develop syncope. There are several variations of physical counter pressure maneuvers, or PCMs. A couple that are commonly looked at, one is hand grip. So imagine you have a stress ball and you squeeze that in your hand. That's one type. Another one is where you kind of lock your hands together and try to pull them apart. The third is you actually cross your legs and flex the muscles of your legs. Another one is you actually try to flex the abdominal muscle. So each of these maneuvers, or PCMs, have been tried and looked at in a variety of different studies. We actually identified a couple of randomized controlled trials looking at these PCMs and how they compared to sometimes to each other, or how they compared to doing nothing, right? Because if you have, back to the case of the dad who's just not feeling good, you know, one thing would be to lay him down, but maybe there's something else you could do that would help alleviate the symptoms faster. And the primary outcome for this was really looking at the prevention of syncope. Could any of these maneuvers help to prevent the individual from developing syncope? There are also several other outcomes, including heart rate and blood pressure and some comparisons between upper body and lower body. But overall, pretty much all of these maneuvers help to prevent development of syncope. So whether that's hand grip, leg crossing, there's also a study looking at having people squat, which may be a little uncomfortable, a little awkward, especially if someone already isn't feeling well and is about to go out on you. But many of these really help to prevent the person from progressing to syncope. And they're easy interventions that we can do. Any of us may be asked at any time to be a first aid provider and can apply these without any other tests, without any other interventions, like I said, IVs or those sorts of things. It's worth having in our toolkit, because even if we call for help for the nurse or somebody else in the department to give us a hand with somebody who is having these symptoms, it may take them a minute or two to get in there, and that may be too long. The person may have developed syncope by then. So each of these maneuvers, whether it's hand grip, leg crossing, can be used.
So it's a matter of how you're coaching dad in this scenario?
So this is an opportunity where you can coach the individual through these maneuvers, through any one of these, and it's not clear that one is vastly superior to another, but that you can coach someone through these to help them with the symptoms that they're having of presyncope.
I just want you to know that asking me to do a squat actually is worse than syncope.
That's right.
The outcomes might be worse, is what I'm saying.
Broken bones, all sorts of stuff.
That's all I'm saying.
That's why. Maybe we'll just start with the hand grip. Maybe you could just, we'll get you, start low, go slow. We'll just start there. Yeah.
That's hilarious. All right. That's great. Well, thank you so much, Justin. I'll make sure that both of those systematic reviews, the links are available through the show notes. And I also know that they're available through ILCOR's website.
The publications, the treatment recommendations are found on ILCOR.org.
Thanks again. I'm looking forward to talking again soon.
ILCOR.